home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am Rob Watson. Garrett Miller is off tonight. But never mind that. We have a fascinating guest and a fascinating topic. As you may be aware, and this is sort of actually kind of unrelated, but just thematically, we'll throw it out there. This week, it in a very bizarre way, it was kind of announced that Barry Manilow came out as being gay. Now, for some people, this was not news because they had a sense for many years that Barry Manilow was gay, and so no surprise to them. For other of us who have watched media, it was not a big surprise because 2 years ago, there was an article out about how Barry Manilow married a man, his partner for many years, then they were now happily married. And so to me, that's coming out. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's like, you know, I think you're gay. You're marrying a man. You know, it's, if you're not gay, then, you know, that would be the surprise. That would be the news. You know, you got married to a man and you're not gay. That would be surprising. So apparently, anyway, my theory is that there's this publicist going on. They have a big story with People magazine. Barry Manilow is actually just talking about being gay the first time publicly. And that's what it's really about. But tonight we are going to be talking to Dr. Lauren Olson, and Dr. Olson's book is finally out, not to Barry Manilow, but coincidentally, Letting Go of Living Straight. And that's where the story is different, because Barry Manilow has not been living straight all these years. He just has not been publicly out. So they're thematically leave what the topic of the evening will be. Very quickly, before I bring Dr. Olson on, I do want to mention, if you are also a listener of Out in Santa Cruz on Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, and you can listen to that through live streaming on KSCO.com or Out in Santa Cruz, all one word, .com. The show there will be the Queer Leadership Awards out of Santa Cruz, Legacy. And the story behind that is that Santa Cruz is a very unique community, not in small part because I live in it, but because it has been progressive for a long time. And one of the progressive things it did 20 years ago was start awards in the local GSAs and clubs in the schools in our system that recognized queer youth and their leadership. And so we are 20 years into that, and a project has now come about where they are looking back at the then kids that won that recognition, and we will be talking about it on Saturday. It should be a unique show, not done elsewhere, so tune in. KSCO.com, 7 p.m. Pacific time. And if you miss it, there will be a recording up. So, but without much more ado, I want to go to tonight's topic, which is finally out. And finally letting him on the show, here is Dr. Olson. Welcome to the show, Dr. Olson.
Yes.
How are you doing?
Good. I lost my internet connection. Yeah.
Ah, well, let's see. You know, did you try calling in also?
I did.
I'm going to answer that other line, and maybe that's going to be you too. Are you online there?
Here I am.
I'm getting feedback.
That's because I'm going to let you go on the one line. So we'll just use this one. Is that better?
Yeah.
There we go. Okay. We love technical difficulties.
Yeah, so I'm sorry. I'm new with this, and it was working fine. I was hearing you fine, and then all of a sudden I lost it. So.
Oh, well, actually, I could hear you fine, and now I can hear you even better. So we're
okay, good.
Good. So now we're off and running. So finally out is, it was fascinating, intelligent read. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the main target for this book, theoretically, are men who are not yet out, maybe in later years. I mean, is that a fair assessment, or did you write it for a different audience?
That was initially the target audience. And then I kind of broadened that because there was interest from family members, from therapists, counselors, clergy. And so I began to look at it more as a book for related to human sexuality and gay history. So I broadened it from what the original intent was.
Yeah, it was very fascinating for me to look at because I read it from the perspective of trying to understand and put, you know, get my feet in the shoes of somebody who came out later in life. You know, I came out, I officially came out and started the real process when I was about 20. But that was after years of internal issues, some of what are reflected in your book, but you know, for me, it was at a younger age and not drawn out over long periods of time where a lot of the people you're talking about, that was the case. But what I found reading the book was I was getting more insight for me as an outsider of people that I have run into in different walks of life, many of which I would say have been adversarial to like the LGBT rights movement. And one thing that is potentially cliche, potentially realistic, is people who tend to be severely homophobic, you know, it is usually assumed it's because they have a reason. And and I found in your book a lot of through line to that as to going into depth on some of these men and what their reality is, and it made it very understandable, not necessarily applauding it, but understandable why they would find such revulsion to out open LGBT rights. And I don't know if that was your intent or that was just this great byproduct of the book.
Well, that was certainly a part of it, was to explore that. And I guess the one that comes to mind, of course, is Senator Craig. And I had life very similar to his. He grew up in Idaho and I grew up in Nebraska, but we grew up at the same time. We were both the same age. And when I heard about his story, and he came out the next day and said, "I'm not gay, I never have been gay," I began to think about how easily that could have been me, and the idea that we grew up in such a bubble, protected from so much of what was going on in other parts of the world. But you know, I was born in 1943, so I'm 74 now, and I had no reference point at all. I grew up in rural Nebraska, in a town of about 1,000. And I was a good boy, but there was nobody that we knew was gay then. And then I went to the University of Nebraska for undergraduate and then to medical school, and I knew no one who was openly gay. Then I went into the Navy, and, of course, it was not a time when people were out in the Navy. And, in fact, part of my job was processing people out of the Navy who were gay. And then I went into my psych residency, and at that time, psychiatry was still saying that homosexuality was a pathologic deviance. So for the first 32 years of my life, I lived in a bubble that really had nothing good to say about being gay.
Right. I want to back up to the one point, because it's interesting you said that. When I came out to my dad, who was in the Marine Corps, that was one of the first responses he had was, he had been on boards in the Marines that were, you know, removing gay Marines out of the Marine Corps. When you were doing that, as you were going through that process, were there any pangs, or did you relate to the people that you were sending out of the military?
I related to them emotionally. I didn't identify with them. I was married, had two children. I thought I was living the life that I was supposed to live, and I really was not conflicted about sexuality at that time. Looking back, there were certain clues that I missed along the way, and yet the idea of it was so abhorrent to me that I really would not allow myself to have that come into my consciousness. I was always the good soldier, and I did what I was told to do, and that meant doing the job that I was supposed to do. And, you know, it was a crazy time because it was during the Vietnam era, and there were times when people were coming in claiming to be gay just to get out of the service, and there were people who, in fact, were gay, so there was a craziness about that. But I still hadn't come to terms with any kind of a gay identity. I still had not met anyone gay at that time. It wasn't until I was out of my residency, actually, that I met my first person who was openly gay.
Well, I related, again, because my experience was much more tight in my life than some of the through line that you described in the book. But I believe you talk about this in the book, sort of like that compartmentalizing sort of in the person's mind, the gay experiences and the rest of them. Like, and that's what I did for, you know, when I was in high school. It was like there was this little gay fantasy place in my head that I go to, but yes. It was really walled up from the rest, you know. Went there, then out.
We all have the capacity to block out things that are very abhorrent to us. And, you know, when somebody says, I don't understand this, how could you do this? I relate it to the story of children in Santa Claus and how when they're very young, they believe it without any question. And then they begin to have clues that something doesn't add up, but they hang on to that belief because it's a privilege to hang on to it and get the goodies that go along with it. And then gradually the facts become overwhelming. The technical word for it is denial. It's a psychological defense. And it's not just like saying, I didn't do it. It's like your mind just absolutely denies the facts that may be apparent to other people. And that's what was working. And I described it in the book as a steel partition in my brain that just separated out all of that from my consciousness at the time.
Yeah, no, it really is fascinating because so much of your book is really digging into the psychology and the culture and, you know, very heady stuff. I mean, and it's not one thing I appreciated from the book. It's not preachy. It's you put out information, but you don't necessarily try to draw conclusions quickly. I mean, it's you sit there and you have to think about it and move on through it. I know for me, when I came out to myself, even it was a split second decision because I was 20 years old and I was tired of not having sex with anybody. And I had a free press and I was looking at ads for massage people. And in an instant, I looked at the ads and I was looking at women masseuses and I knew what they were about and all that. And my head instantly went, you know, you're not going to tell anybody about this. This is going to be a complete secret. And then a thought hit me that was sort of profound that just flew in. It was like, you might as well go to somebody that you really want. And it was a man. You know, It was like, I didn't think about it. I didn't muse on it. I didn't make a big decision. It was like, just all of a sudden, it's like that crack, boom, you know, out it came. You know, And it was like a big surprise. in the book, you talk about the movie, and I'm jumping around your book a lot, but you talk about the movie Making Love, and it seemed that seemed to have an impact on you. Was that accurate?
Yes, it did. I mean, it certainly, I mean, the fact that it depicted men loving each other in a healthy way was kind of a new idea for me because, you know, we were all raised in basically the same culture, and the culture that I was raised in had a stereotype of men that they were always promiscuous and could not sustain relationships and incapable of enduring commitment to anyone. And it was certainly not a life that I wanted for myself, but in watching that, they were characterizing it as two men who really loved each other in the way that I expected any two people would. And so I was very curious about that, and it sort of began to expand my thinking about it and began to ask more questions about it. But it was kind of frightening to watch it for me at the time, too, because it did stimulate some curiosity about it.
Well, and you described how you were watching it sort of over the shoulder of your wife, who was
yeah.
the one actually watching it, and trying to make sure nothing, you didn't telegraph anything, you know.
Yeah, she was watching it on the couch, and I was sitting at the dining room table behind her, and I didn't want to show too much interest in what was going on. She was quite interested in it, and I just didn't want to appear to be too curious about it at the time.
Yeah, I think that kind of situation is some of the harshest for people in the closet. I know it was for me. What is that when you're in those situations and there's no script, you know, laid out for you on, you know, how to hide, and you're in that being presented and people around you are showing an interest in something. And for me, it was, okay, how do I react? How do I do this? What do I, you know, what's enough, what's not too much, what's, you know, that whole inside debate going on?
Yeah, I think it's constant, you know, that you protect what you say, you protect what you do, you try not to give anything away, and it's a lot of work and a lot of stress. And, you know, if you ever say, I think I might be gay, or I'm curious about this, the assumption from the other person is that you must be gay. And, you know, that once it crosses your lips, it's out there, and
right.
it's going to be shared by other people. And, you know, the other thing about it, Rob, is that there was nobody that I knew that I could talk to about it. I didn't know anybody in the world was feeling the same kind of confusion that I was. And so it was a great sense of isolation without any process of discussing it with anyone.
Right. Yeah. Very, very lonely. Now, moving to when you kind of fell into writing the book, because you didn't really intend to, you said in the book, you were actually researching LGBT seniors and their plight. Tell us how it evolved from that to what the project actually turned into.
Well, I started by trying to validate whether my hypothesis about coming out being different for older people was valid. I wanted to see if there were other people who thought it was different, because what you've described is sort of the classic process of self coming out to yourself and then coming out to another and having the whole process finished by mid-20s. That was the Vivian Cass model of the coming out process. And, of course, at the time I was in my residency, probably reading about that, I was 35 and thinking, well, you know, that time has passed. I must not be gay. You know, it sort of validated that. Well, it led into discussions with other people and doing a survey and trying to, and I found out there were a lot of men who had a similar experience to mine. And then, of course, I got older, and I struggled with getting older. And I met a man in Houston, and I was speaking to a group there. And when I finished, he raised his hands in the air, and he said, I'm 82, and this is the best time in my life. And I really thought, what does he know that I should know? And I began then to explore the idea that there are things that happen as we get older that give us a new sense of freedom and opportunities that we never had before. And so I began to look at that think about aging as an adventure, an opportunity to do some of the things that we couldn't do when we were obsessed with getting ahead and climbing the ladder of success and doing all of that. So that was what led into my interest in older people.
Right. And then you joined a group of fathers who were, I don't know if they were identifying as gay or they were identifying as being men who had sex with men, but they also helped formulate
things
for you.
It was a group. I think I saw it as an ad in the classifieds in the Des Moines Register, as I recall, and it just said a support group for gay fathers. I was very nervous about going because I didn't really know anyone there. I walked into a room where there were probably a dozen or 15 men there, and the thing about it, the experience for me, Rob, was that there were men of all kinds there. You know, none of them really exactly fit the stereotype, or some came closer to than others. But it almost immediately shattered the stereotypes that I had, and I recognized that the gay community is quite a diverse group. The thing that we all had in common was that we had children and we'd been married, and that we were all very committed to trying to figure out how to continue to be the best fathers we could under the circumstances. And so that was a great deal of support for me at that time. And some of those men are still my friends now. This would be 40 years later.
Now, was this a group that one of the members was actually murdered that you talked about in the book?
Yes. One of the men in that group, who was exactly my age, had two daughters. I had two daughters, and we were friends with him. And his relationship with his partner broke up, and he went out and was cruising and brought a couple of guys home, and they stabbed him to death.
Yeah, that's horrible. And I've, throughout my life, when I was in high school, my parents had a friend, and my parents were in the kind of the Republican group of the town we lived in. And he was in that group. He was, you know, the single man, and, you know, nobody really talked about his private life. You know, it was sort of like kind of knew but didn't know. And anyway, he didn't die, but he was, you know, brought somebody home who, you know, attacked him and left him for dead. And then years later, a friend of mine, and this was in West Hollywood, you know, the man was out, older, but, you know, like kind of street trade. And one of those guys killed him. It's just, is that still, I mean, are we getting to a point where that kind of activity is not happening as homosexual, being gay is more acceptable and mainstream, or do we still have those pockets of kind of thugs laying in wait for older men?
Well, I think it's certainly still exists. And right now it seems to be particularly a risk for the trans community. I don't know the exact number, but there have been quite a few trans people who've been murdered this year, and they seem to be catching the brunt of it now. And I think partly that's because it's so much in the news, and it's a reaction to that. But that certainly still exists. There are people who meet through Grindr and invite them to their home, and they have no idea who they're inviting into their home. And so I think it's still a pretty high risk. I mean, an older person is vulnerable to somebody who is younger and stronger and may come with a weapon. And when you open that door, you may not know who's coming in.
Right, absolutely. I'm going to shift a little bit to the psychology, some of the psychology you talk about in the book. One thing you talk about in for a lot of these men who are dealing with their sexuality and they're living, quote unquote, the straight life, that they are dealing with rational versus feeling thought. And can you lay those out a little bit of what those are and how that plays into this?
Well, I think, you know, we operate with our a part of our brain, which is rational, which is about 1% of our brain. And then the rest of our brain operates with sort of instinctual and primal kinds of forces. And most of our things, like our appetite, our sexual appetite, and those things are driven by internal forces like that. And that 1% part of our brain is what has the ability to complete rational planning, changing, overriding those impulses. But it's a constant battle for anyone to maintain that control over those feelings. And, you know, in some ways we want to be able to access those feelings too, because they're responsible for creativity and high energy and pleasure and all of those things. For men who have sex with men, I like the word or the description of MSM, because it's a behavioral description. It's not a description of identity, because it incorporates a lot of people like that. But many of them are conflicted about their sexuality, and they have sex in high-risk places, often accompanied by drugs and or alcohol, which impairs even that 1% of their brain. And so they're not always thinking clearly, not always doing what might keep them safe. But it's a constant battle that we all go through, trying to do the right thing. And whether it's alcohol, drugs, gambling, overeating, whatever it is, those are things which we aren't always in rational control of.
Right, right. And throughout the book, again, you go very into a lot of the therapeutic causes and struggles that are going on in the minds of people who are coming out or haven't come out yet. And you talk about Dr. Levinson's model for self-esteem. And then another place you talk about DNA, culture. You've got a different model of factors that are weighing on the person. Can you kind of give an overview of those elements and how what's going on for the person that they're dealing with, why their reality may not be as clear as people from the outside who are already out and kind of going, gee, what's the matter? Come out, you know?
Yes. The model that I like for a lot of that, Rob, is the idea that most things that we deal with in psychology or psychiatry are a combination of biology, psychology, and sociology. The biology, of course, is a reflection of the DNA. Psychology tends to do with those developmental circumstances that we grew up in, and then the sociology are the contemporary world that we live in. And all of us have certain biological predispositions. And, you know, they talk about whether or not being gay is genetic or inherited. And I suspect that there's probably a tendency that's inherited, but how it plays out for different people, I think, is a product of their psychology and sociology, their developmental circumstances, and the world that they live in. And if I look at it in my own life, I have other members of my family that are gay. I have, but I lived in a developmentally in a world where there was no exposure, no evidence of anyone living that life. And then in the sociological part of it, the contemporary world that I experienced all through my medical training and everything led me to believe that if I came out as gay, that I would have been thrown out of medical school and out of my residency and out of the military too. So it wasn't until I could get through all that I really would even allow myself to think about anything like that. But I think, you know, when we try and make it too specific, we lose it kind of as kind of reductionistic, and it's better if we consider all of those elements and how they contribute, and that's what makes us all different in the way that we different, and your life experience and my life experience are different because of the ways that we were raised and lived with the lives that we were inherited.
Right.
So it's a combination of all those things that operate with a different degree of force for each individual.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I like what you're saying about uniqueness, because that's been something a concept I've been dealing with recently, is just appreciating how unique each individual is. I mean, you know, we know our DNA model is unique. We know our fingerprints are unique. But we seem to leave it at those little marker things and not realize that, you know, the complexity of us can be equally unique. And the chances of us being us is sort of like winning the lottery. I mean, there were, you know, millions of sperm molecules going towards one egg. I mean, that combination could have been anything. And it was the one that got through that created our individual pattern, you know, on this little planet, you know, which, you know, there are billions of planets, and, you know, we're the ones that happen to have life going. And, you know, I mean, it's just like the miracle of a single life is pretty profound when you,
it sure is. It really is. Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that happens in our culture right now with this tremendous polarity that we have is that we assume that we are being, those of us who are gay or bi, that we are all very much alike, and that all those people who oppose us are very much alike. And it creates great barriers. You know, we tend to define their group and they tend to define us. And as long as we do that, we make a lot of misjudgments about who these people are and they about who we are. When we do that, we define them based on the stereotypes that we have of them and they of us. And, you know, even within our own community, we're not as much alike as we used to think. You know, we now have so many variations of LGBTQI, you know, on and on. And I have begun to think of sexuality more as a matrix rather than a spectrum, with many, many different possibilities of a way
right.
that it can be expressed.
Yeah, actually, so I'm gonna pull the age card on you, because I came out and was out I'm out and about before you were, just based on when you watched Making Love, and I was already out in the community at that point. So, you know, but you know, it's funny because in those days, community is one of those words that actually drives me crazy, because I don't really, I mean, I certainly have LGBT communities in my life, that there isn't one overriding one. You know, it's sort of like, as soon as somebody has different sexuality than heterosexuality, they step into the community, and it's sort of a fictitious concept. But anyway, but at that time, gay men did not like lesbians. Lesbians did not like gay men. You know, it was like just all these fractured, oppressed groups that, you know, sort of came together, and especially came together with AIDS, where, you know, all the oppression sort of drove us to a common place of being commonly oppressed. you know, and that that galvanizes. But yeah, it's so it's interesting. Speaking of the LGBTQI, you know, spectrum there, in the book you talk about, I think you're referring to an actual paper, the messy realities of bisexuality.
Yeah.
And I found that really fascinating because, and I want you to describe it as you talked about there, but because I've dealt with a lot of bisexual activists and, you know, very, very rightly concerned about bi invisibility that happens where they just are not even acknowledged in today's society or conversation and that type of thing. And but they rankle at the idea of this bisexuality being the transitional stage. And you talk about this in the book that you, one psychologist at a something you attended actually said that was what it was.
Yes.
But they rankle at that. And I always feel very apologetic because when I came out, my first identity out of being straight was to say that I was bi. And
mm-hmm.
when I read your book, I found a lot more reason why that was me than I had acknowledged before. So with that, that lengthy preface, what was your take on the messy realities of bisexuality?
Well, it can get me into trouble, I'll tell you.
Go ahead. We love trouble.
I know that, you know, there are people who are quite committed to the idea of bisexual as a separate identity. And yet, for me, it's almost too large an umbrella. For one thing, that and you know, as a scientist, in order to study a group, you have to have some clear guidelines of who is included in that. So that's one issue. I think the other thing that is confusing is that many of us who have now come out as a gay did go through a transition period where we, I mean, I was married and having sex with my wife as I had a boyfriend and was having sex with him. That's pretty bisexual behavior. And so I didn't have any other word to describe it other than to think of myself as bisexual.
Right.
But, you know, it was a very brief transition. And so I think, you know, that the people who are really advocating for this have a right to come out and advocate for their position. But it is a kind of a muddy category in a lot of ways. I guess in terms of labels, Rob, I think that we can only label ourselves. That when we try and label other people, we get into big trouble. For me, I'm gay because that's what I identify as. And I think about it in terms of the kind of the four dimensions of sexuality. We have sexual drive, we have sexual fantasies, we have sexual behavior, we have sexual activity. And when all those come together for me and they're all aligned, that's when I consider myself gay. Now, for somebody else, they may have a sexual behavior with one or both sexes. They may have fantasies about another, and then they may lack consistency even within the same individual. So I truly believe that there are people who are bisexual. I certainly know that I don't feel like I'm one of them.
Right, right, and I neither do I. I mean, I don't cling to that identity, and it was. One, I was kind of called on pretty quickly. You know, a friend of mine was saying, "Why are you? I never see you with a girl." And it's like, "Oh, that, that movie." You know. So, it was interesting to me though in some of the descriptions, because one of the things that some friends of mine have said is that they experience more biphobia from gay and lesbian people than they do from heterosexual people, and one of the things that I guess from your book that stood out to me was sort of the characteristic, a lot of the men who are closeted, that and doing this compartmentalizing within themselves, where in their, you know, their relationship is their heterosexual one, and then they go out and they have sort of this other relationship, but it's in the compartment. So it's not mm-hmm. like real, and it's not really them, and it's like not a priority and everything else. Well, a lot of gay people who are the other side of those relationships got burned, you know, and damaged from that experience. And so I think that's where a lot of the biphobia that has become legacy comes from, of, you know, mm-hmm. distrust. And, you know, it's, and it's not fair to people who are assertively, proudly, comfortably, definitively bisexual that are out to, yes, I mean, this goes back to your point you just made. It should be made on an individual basis. But it just, mm-hmm. I just found insight based on your writing that, you know, that that helped propel this forward.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. It is. I know when that article came out in Psychology Today, there I still get comments from it, and it's probably been 5 or 6 years ago that I wrote it, and there was a lot of comments, and some of them were very hostile, and then there were others who were quite supportive and were saying that they were misreading what I had intended to say, but it's died down a little bit now, but I'm also kind of cautious at times.
I hope we didn't just... it's like, damn, I shouldn't have done that darn interview. It just burned it right up.
No,
again.
I know it. I knew it was going to come up for sure, and it needs to come up. I mean, I'm not afraid to address it. I'm not afraid to be wrong, and I'm not afraid to hear someone else's position who might define it in a different way than I do. But for me, it's just kind of a murky category for a lot of people, not for everybody, for sure. And I suppose part of my opinion is colored by the fact that I know so many men who may still be in heterosexual marriages that define themselves as bisexual, or men who have seen it as a transition. And I know that that's not everybody. You know, I saw a patient just last week who talked about being gender fluid, and his wife left him and said, "I'm not," you know.
Right.
And she didn't want anything to do with that. And I was interviewed by another trans man the other day, and, you know, he first came out as a lesbian and then decided to be trans and still trying to determine whether or not he's attracted to men or women, you know. And so I think, again, it goes back to the idea of matrix, that we're all individuals and we all have our own certain fetishes or interests or attractions. And I don't think we have a clue yet what determines what draws us in one direction or another.
Right. Well, and to your point about culture and society and all those factors, there've been multiple studies, and unfortunately none of the studies were exactly the same in their control groups and everything else. So it's, you have to kind of read between the lines on this, but the upshot is, when talking to younger people who are coming out or who are experiencing the world at a time when this is all out in the open and being discussed, and, you know, they're not being necessarily handed an expectation of you are going to be heterosexual, you know, unless, you know, oops, you know, that they're actually given that the bandwidth to explore themselves. And in these various studies, the upshot is roughly that about 30% of, and I forget, it's 18, I think it's the 24-year-olds. Actually, I think that age range varies based on these studies as well, but let's just say young people. But about 30% identify as something other than heterosexual. You know, they're not necessarily calling themselves bisexual or, you know, those type things and identifying with that purely. But I think that says something. I think that really supports your matrix concept, you know, mm-hmm. with this generation, which will probably be the first one that has the freedom to look at themselves that way.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, Rob, how that unfolds as they get older, and if it changes any as they do. I think there's a big difference between being in your 20s and being in your 30s, and life gets a bit more serious at 30. And I will be interested to see how that unfolds. I don't have any predictions, but it may be sort of just where we're at right now. But there's certainly a lot of people who talk more about things like gender fluid and sexual attraction or orientation being more fluid. And so those things are concepts which were not even talked about when I was young, and perhaps not when you were either.
They're new. So speaking of parts of the book that could get you into trouble,
you're coming at me again.
I know. There's one part where you got some feedback that pedestry is the core of the movement, of the gay movement. And you talked really frankly in the book about, you know, the concept of sexuality and adolescence, and can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that when it originally was brought to my attention, it actually was pederasty was not a word that I knew, and I was accused of being one. And
look that up and see.
I have to figure out what this is to see if I am or not. A lot of the alt-right or the evangelical right have conflated pedophilia and pederasty. And pedophilia is really an attraction to a child who has not developed any secondary sexual characteristics like pubic hair or breasts or anything like that. They really still look like a child. Pederasty is attraction to someone who is developing a secondary sexual characteristic but is still underage. So it could be anyone, say, maybe from 14 to 16 or 18, depending on what the age of consent is in the different places. Well, the thing about it is, you know, there's all this that's happened within the Catholic Church about pedophiles and pederasty. But in fact, there are a lot of gay men who have had sex during their teenage years with an adult and didn't feel like they were abused or they were drawn into it and they didn't feel like that they were violated in any way. But then there are those who have been violated. And it becomes a very sticky area. At what age a child is really capable of giving consent about that? And, you know, laws have to be arbitrary because there's no other way around it. If we look at the age when kids begin to have sex now, it's like 25% at age 14, and by the time they're 19, it's I think 85% or something like that. So there's a whole group of people that are becoming sexually active during that period of time more and more. Well, sometimes they may have sexual activity with someone who's a few years older. And in the past, nobody thought too much about it with girls, but it was boys. There was a different age of consent for girls and for boys. Girls were thought to and do, in fact, mature sexually earlier in general. But there are certainly boys who mature pretty young as well. But a mature physical body doesn't mean a mature physical or a mature mind. And somebody who may be very physically mature may not have the capability to really give an informed consent of joining into it. So, again, it's an area that's complicated and difficult to set rules about. We just have to protect those people who are incapable of protecting themselves.
Right, right. I wanted to just ask a big overview question. You know, there are men out there who are starting to feel like this might be them. They pick up your book. What things do you want them to focus on and think about that's going on in their own minds to help them through that? What is the big takeaway for them?
I think, you know, the big thing is that you're not alone in this, that other people have been through this, that there are many ways to get through it. There's no right or wrong way. You can come out as little or as much as you want to. But I think the overriding message is one of hope. If we look at the rates of suicide for gay men, they're about three times the general population, and most of those occur at a time of coming out. And there's a doctor in Australia who talks about predicament suicide and the idea that sometimes in life we're faced with a predicament from which there seems to be no escape. Either of the choices that you're going to make are awful, you know. And,
right.
And that was kind of the way I was. I mean, I wasn't suicidal, but I felt at the time I can't choose not to be with my family, but I can't choose not to be gay. I don't know how to get through this. And I kind of was hoping that someone would come and make the decision for me because I didn't know what to do. So I think it's a process that goes on. I think it's important for those people to find either a healthy therapist or a healthy adult who can that they can talk with, and someone who will accept them whatever they decide to do. But it isn't always easy, and particularly in some places. And you know, I've heard some very tragic stories from people in the Middle East and in India and Africa, places where there's just no opportunity to talk to anyone.
Right. Yeah, definitely. You had made references to this before. I don't know if we went to enough depth on it, but you actually did a study, and you talk about in the book of when people come out, you know, when they're younger versus when they're older. What were some of the big takeaways that we haven't talked about yet from your study work on that?
Well, I think, you know, when you come out at an older age, you have developed a complicated network of relationships. The closest, of course, being family, but your friendships are based on heterosexual presumption. You're often at work, you know, your cultural connections, your community connections, those things are all based on the expectation that you're heterosexual. And so it's a more complicated matter, I think, to disentangle that. You know, a person who comes out when they're 15 to 25 doesn't have all that degree of relationships. I think makes it much more complicated to try and unravel that. And you do lose friends, you can lose family. I mean, there are losses that go along with it, and people have to be realistic about that and accept that as a reality. And there's a principle from economics that says in considering these kinds of decisions, we magnify the negative and we minimize the positive. And, you know, all we focus on when we're considering this decision are the losses. And it's hard to know what the gains are going to be if you come out. And it's difficult for those of us who have come out to convey to them what that feeling of freedom and authenticity and wholeheartedness and just a sense of freedom is like. That's the payoff for us when we do it. But we pay a price for it.
Right. Yeah. And at the beginning of the show, I was talking about the Barry Manilow story that just broke, although sort of still weird to me since, like I said, he got married 2 years ago and it's another thing, he's gay now. So it's like, okay, whatever. But I still can see some of the elements that you just talked about, even being experienced at the celebrity level, you know, it may be more public people coming on board, going away, you know, his public persona changing, you know, if he has been really, really out in his private life. But
I just wrote a short essay about that today, talking about it. Barry Manilow is not somebody that's going to shock anybody, but it's not exactly like he's an NFL fullback or something that would make perhaps bigger news. But I think I have just read briefly about it. And it sounds like his fears were the same as my fears, the fears of loss and what would come of it. And whether or not they were valid, whether or not they were overblown, his sense of feeling that he might lose his fans, his friends, his income was probably very real to him, or he wouldn't have waited so long. We've seen that in a number of celebrities who've come out, that they fear losing everything, and some have lost a good deal. But I think that's the issue, is that he couldn't know what he was up against and didn't want to take the risk.
That's really very insightful. Thank you for that. I really appreciate that input on that. So, Dr. Olson, believe it or not, we are down to our final 3 minutes here.
It flew by, didn't
the hour.
It?
First of all, where can people find the book?
The book is available any place people buy books. If it's not in your bookstore, you can order it, and it's available online from Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And if they want to go to my website, it's laurenaolson.com. And I have a fact sheet about male sexuality and how it expresses and evolves over time, which they can get by going to finallyouttips.com. That is something that's been interesting to me to see. To help men understand that there is a process of it, the way our sexuality evolves, our sex lives, I guess, evolves over our lifespan, and that there are ways to preserve that if we know what that evolution is like. I always say that I object to the word sexual performance, because it sounds like we're expecting people to applaud and give us a bouquet of roses after it's over.
But they don't. Always happens for me. No.
It's never happened in my experience. One of the advantages of getting older is to begin to refocus on sexual pleasure rather than performance.
There you go.
And
good. Very good. And so this is the second edition of the book. And, the title again is Finally Out, Letting Go of Living Straight, author Dr. Lauren Olson. And laurenaolson.com was their website, correct?
laurenaolson.com, yeah.
Great. So, well, thank you so much for being on board. This has been fascinating. The book is... has a lot of meat to it. We barely scratched the surface of some of the depth that goes into. So I highly recommend people check that out and read it, share it with people who it could do some real solid good for, and read it yourself, because it'll give you a lot of insight to the type of people that share our world. With that, Thank you again to my guest, and listen to Out in Santa Cruz. And you can hear that live stream, KSCO.com, Saturday, 7 p.m. I'm Rob Watson for Rated LGBT Radio. Over and out.